My name is Oscar Scheller, and I perform under the name Oscar.
You studied sculpture. You have a musical family. You played piano when you were young. Northwest London. Now, I'm trying to pull out my map, and over here is the Queen is there, and wait, Rough Trade's over there. Northwest London.
Yeah, east and south is definitely now the thing. And
you're not, so wait a minute, Northwest, what's wrong with you?
I'm just kind of an out-of-towner, I guess. No, I'm a real Londoner, but I just live in a not-cool place, which is kind of cool in a way.
And is that because the rent's cheaper? Because I'll bet all the cool places that were dumps and dangerous are now expensive.
Well, most of London's cleaned up now, so even the place that I live is getting more expensive as time goes on.
Let's go for the musical family first. There's probably some better stories than the typical ones there.
Well, my mum and dad met in a squat party in the mid-70s.
Define a squat. I know what a squat is, but just for the people who might not know.
It's a place where, it's an abandoned house where people often will reside. And in the 70s and early 80s, there were a lot of squats in London because a lot of London was derelict still and undeveloped. So you could find these incredible houses for free. I mean, all you'd have to do is break in maybe and get a mattress down and throw a party.
So they met there. And what do you think they bonded over?
Just how much they fancied each other, I guess.
Nothing wrong with that.
Well, so my mum's older brother was best friends with my dad. And so my mum went to this party, was like, "Can let me come to this party with you?" You know, she was like the younger sister. And that's where they met. Well, they started writing songs together, and then they formed the band The Regents. And the reason it's called The Regents is because the squat was behind Regents Park. Then they got a record deal. They were on Top of the Pops. With a song called 17, which was about my mum, who was 17 when she met my dad.
How long was the gestation of The Regents?
Well, it was short-lived, unfortunately, which was nothing to do with their musical integrity. It was more kind of the musical politics of the 80s and how many horrible, horrible people were around then and how much money was flying around. So
how much publishing was owned and lost.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, they were written off as a tax loss because of various, you know, major label shenanigans.
Were they on a major?
They were on Arista. Yeah.
They were in Arista in the UK. Interesting.
In the UK, and they recorded with Connie Plank in. They went to Cologne to his little shack. Yeah, and so the record's great. It was just almost a bit too ahead of its time. My dad was using a lot of synths and sampling a lot when it wasn't really like a la mode. Yeah.
And so, how did that get into your DNA? And at what? When you were born, the Regents were long gone, weren't they?
Yeah, they were long gone. I think my sister might have caught the tail end of it. But it kind of seeped in because my mum was always singing and playing keyboard around the house and writing songs when I was a baby and I was sitting on her lap. My dad had his own studio in Ladbroke Grove. He was making Acid House at the time. I was always around music, and they were always throwing parties with musicians and stuff, so it definitely went in somewhere.
But using breakbeats from 90s era rap records and sneaking that sort of thing in, now back to Acid House, back to sampling, back to the Regents, it did get in your DNA in a major way.
Yeah, well, I think I definitely have both dance and punk, like, music in my blood.
Dunk. We've got a new genre, dunk.
There you go, we got it.
I just made it up here. I think we've got this. Let's see, Oscar's music. It's the latest thing. It's dunk.
Dunk, yeah, I'm down with that. Yeah. You could say ESG was dunk, because that's kind of disco, punky,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
That kind of vibe. I think, I also listen to a lot of hip-hop, so I think that's where it comes from as well. Yeah.
You're sitting in your bedroom, and you're starting to make music. Where did you suddenly come to a point where you said, wait a minute, I think I've got something here. I think I'll take it to the next level.
It started with the fact that I couldn't have a drum kit in my house because I lived in a flat above and below someone. So couldn't make the noise. And so I just downloaded like a hip old school drum loop folder, and I had some samples that I'd recorded from vinyl. And I just started laying them down like that, and I thought, I'm going to replace them with real drums at one point. You know, this is just a stopgap. But then eventually I started to realize that so much of the kind of vibe and atmosphere was given at the very start by the sample, and that's why sampling's so special to me. And so it became a huge part of the sound, yeah.
But then there's that moment, and I'm purposely skipping around, where you go, oh, wait a minute, I have to play this stuff for people.
yeah, that was...
And then it's kind of like, oh, okay, I guess I do have to add the live drums.
Yeah, which was kind of annoying. I was like, I don't want to just... I didn't want it to be so normal, you know, to have, like, traditional acoustic drums, yeah. I didn't want to be, like, a rock kid or whatever, because that's just not my vibe. But, you know, so when I started playing live, it was with a drum machine, and I sampled, had, like, everything on a kind of backing track with these pretty lo-fi samples, and then eventually I got a drummer, and he can play like the old school samples. So
yeah, so that's a tricky thing, is you have to make sure that he can be as loose as you want him to be, right?
Yeah, he's very funky. I mean, he loves lots of like crazy wonky swung stuff. He's really into like Erykah Badu and like all that kind of, you know, the super like soulful drumming stuff. So yeah, he's really cool into that.
You know, it's interesting about the world, because we live in this bubble. Like, half of the people have no idea what Wichita is. How many people approached you to sign you, and how did you decide?
I had a few, actually. The first was Sub Pop, and actually they...
How interesting.
Yeah, so they... it was off a demo that I'd put up on SoundCloud, and I was very excited, quite like... surprised, actually. I didn't think...
Yeah, that's an interesting... But then they've done Father John... You know, they've done... Yeah. They've kind of gone aside and done some really interesting things you'd never expect.
So I met up with them in CMJ and also in London, and they sent me a deal very quickly. It was a very bad deal.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely no faith in new artists.
Wow, from Sub Pop.
Yep, you heard it here first. Yeah, well, it was one A&R guy there who was really behind me and really wanted to sign me, and we got on really well. And he kind of was a big Smiths fan and was like a big kind of UK, you know, Anglophile. So I didn't go with them. Wichita were the second to offer, and it was sort of, you know, a really good relationship from the very start. So I played a terrible pub in Notting Hill. It was like an all-dayer pub, and the roof actually fell through, not whilst I was playing, but later on in the evening. And I had a lawyer. That was the only thing I had. My music lawyer said, I'm going to bring my friend, this guy. He didn't tell me who. And it was one of the A&R from Wichita called Ben Wildman, and he came and he loved it. And he kept coming to shows. He came to two more shows, and then he told Mark Bowen, who lives in LA, he was like, Mark wants to come fly over and see you play. And I was like, wow, this is really like happening, I guess. So then I signed with them. And after I signed with them, Atlantic started like knocking on the door, you know, always a bit too late. Which I just felt like to sign to a major would be such a disservice to what I'm trying to do right now, because they have, you know, it's a business. There's very little faith, there's very little like growing space, and it's just not a very healthy or natural place for an artist who's starting out, I don't think.
You still did go with a real mixer. You were smart enough to know that you take your stuff from the bedroom and someone still has to put it through certain things to get there, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not gonna say that I could ever mix anything in my whole life, because it's really such a different head, you know, you have to have a different hat on. And I think it's much better for someone else to do that.
I have to do this one because it's just so obvious. Difficult turning to Daffodil. Autocorrect is either the greatest thing in the world. I mean, how many texts do you send and then you send it, you know, have you seen those things on the internet? But, you know, it would have been a very, very different song with the word difficult.
Absolutely. I think, you know, there is a ghost in the machine. I do believe that, like, they are... They are sentient in some way, because, yeah, you know, we're around them so much, there's no way that they can't not be. It was a real turn, you know, and it made the song what it is, I guess.
Front page of the NME, front page of this, the review in Mojo, the blah, blah, blah. And look, if you get lucky and you do sell 300,000 copies in the UK and you get your gold record, that can be a good career. However, The U.S. is this entirely different, ridiculous beast. When you kind of step back and go, okay, I'm going to do this. I want to have a career. There's a lot of hype around me already. What do you think? Are you ready to conquer the U.S., Oscar?
I feel pretty good about America, yeah. Hype's a funny thing, and I think my relationship with it is quite funny as well, because I'm so aware of it. I've seen so many bands fly up and drop off in my time,
exactly.
My short time. I just think it's a very fickle, fickle world, and everyone's very quick to forget. And I think really you just have to be as real as you can be, and just be as consistent as you can be, and hope for the best, because you just don't know what's going to happen. But I do feel ready, that's for sure.
Okay, and I'm going to continue to be evil here because it's so much fun. You talk about writing for other people, and there's this quote. You talk about Radio One, and you talk about dropping songs for not selling, and, you know, and basically, you know, major labels treating artists as because, you know, if a song drops and it doesn't suddenly sell, it's kind of like, yeah, well, artist development goes out the window. So you've spoke up about that early on.
It's a really interesting one, and it's one I like to study, actually. I like to look at people's careers and the trajectory and sort of see how it's gone. It's just more like a business studies project. I think there's not as much belief in new music, I would say. But I think the lack of belief is actually in the industry and the gatekeepers who haven't really changed in the last 20 years, and sort of have are being forced to change because of how sort of I guess temperamental and tempestuous the kind of technological musical age has made everything, you know, the internet, streaming, statistics, everything like that, you know, the whole game has changed and they're trying to keep up with it. So I think that...
And they don't know.
They don't know anything.
So I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs as the bread on the outside, and then songs by others on the inside.